Hi, this is Will Friedle. In a world that sometimes feels uncertain, where communities can be disconnected, there are beacons of hope in your neighborhood. Introducing Neighbor to Neighbor, a California volunteers network. They believe that the people living all around you are your best bet at creating meaningful social bonds and preparing you for the next big weather event. Whether it's lending a helping hand to a neighbor in need or standing together in times of natural disaster, Neighbor to Neighbor empowers you to grow your community. Visit caneighbors.com to learn how you can help build a more connected community. Neighbor to neighbor, it takes a neighborhood.
Hi, I'm Jeremy Stahl. I'm Slate's jurisprudence editor. Ordinarily, I edit our courts and legal coverage from the comfort of my home office in Los Angeles, but for the next month and a half, I will be locked in a lower Manhattan courtroom with the rest of the press, a jury of 12 New Yorkers, Justice Juan Merchan, prosecutors, Trump's defense team, and the former president himself as history unfolds. I've temporarily moved myself and my family from Los Angeles to New York to cover this case firsthand, like I have done in other cases, including the Paul Manafort case, the Roger Stone criminal trial, and Donald Trump's first impeachment. I'm hoping that my background knowledge of the many, many criminal travails of our former president can offer something to you, Slate's listener. Over the next several weeks, you'll be hearing from me on Amicus, Slate's legal podcast, and in articles on Slate.com, from the jury selection to the opening arguments to the witness testimony and cross-examination and the prosecution's case and the defense's case, and ultimately to a final verdict. We will be providing you wall-to-wall coverage throughout the entirety of the trial as it unfolds from the courtroom. There's no way I'd be able to do it without the support of Slate Plus. So if you're not already a subscriber, please join today by clicking Try Free at the top of the Amicus show page on Apple Podcasts, or visit slate.com/amicusplus to get access wherever you listen. Thank you so, so much.
The following podcast contains explicit language.
Hello and welcome to the Slate Political Gabfest Extra for
extra
May 5th, 2017. The healthcare, the ACA returns Gabfest, the Gabfest Extra on Trump Care, on Ryan Care, on the end of Obamacare, if it is in fact the end of Obamacare. I'm David Plotz of Atlas Obscura. I'm here in Washington, D.C. John Dickerson of CBS's Face the Nation is on the phone. He's somewhere else. And Emily Bazelon of the New York Times Magazine is in her home hobbit hole of New Haven. Hi, guys. How are you?
Hey. Glenn.
So, Emily, let's start with you. Yesterday, as we were taping the regular show, the House was preparing to vote on the revised repeal of Obamacare. And they voted, and with a narrow majority, House Republicans passed a repeal bill that will now go to the Senate. So were you surprised that they were able to get a majority to do this after they had apparently failed 6 weeks ago?
I guess I was surprised, like, in the beginning of last week that this seemed to have real momentum. By the time it passed, it seemed like that was what was going to happen. I mostly just find this, like, profoundly dispiriting. I have to say, I really feel sorrow about the state of the nation. I mean, look, this bill probably, I suppose, in its current form will not become law, but it was rushed through in such an irresponsible fashion. It has the power to hurt millions of people. And I just kind of can't believe that this is where the country is. And the idea of taking $1 trillion from low-income and middle-class people and giving it back to the wealthiest few over health insurance. I felt like I was watching the extension of some conservatives' idea that that virtue is its own reward, that if you're living a good life, that's because you deserve to. That idea, which I don't agree with to begin with, the idea of applying that to whether people are healthy or sick, I really feel kind of blown away by this.
John, as a political matter, is this a extreme, celebratory triumph for the president and for House Republicans? Or was that ceremony yesterday at the White House where President Trump and leaders of the Republican caucus huzzahed themselves? Was that overblown?
This is a triumph. Is it a triumph worthy of the White House ceremony? No, because in part, if you are, as a Republican president, can't get the House, where you have more control than in the Senate, to vote in support of something that they've campaigned on for the last 7 years, if that's a big, tough thing, then you've got a lot of challenges ahead of you. I think part of what that was about was creating momentum, creating a sense of progress and team spirit so that they put some pressure on the Senate to not undo it.
The original AHCA bill failed to go to a vote because there was an enormous objection from the House Freedom Caucus, the most conservative members of the Republican caucus, and enormous objection from the moderates, the Tuesday group, I think they're called, who both of whom objected. And so the bill was made much more conservative to please the Freedom Caucus, who then generally came over and voted for it. Why did the moderates also defect and end up voting for it, Emily? Why did they not stick to their principles about it?
Well, I mean, there was a lot of political pressure on them to come into line, a lot of whipping of votes by Paul Ryan. Reince Priebus was putting on pressure from the White House. And I suppose Trump was doing that, too, in his disengaged with the details way. And party loyalty won out. And also, the Republicans have, of course, been talking for 8 years about repealing Obamacare. Here was their chance to do that. And so to be the last body blocking that from happening, there just weren't enough Republicans who were willing to play that role. And I gather from the remarks that some of them were making today that they don't think this version of the bill is either a good idea or will actually become law. And so this whole idea of momentum, that you just pass something, you send this over to the Senate will somehow have their own challenges and they'll present a bill which is not this one. And then it will be back in the House's corner and the House Freedom Caucus presumably will be the ones with the hard choice to make about whether to stand in the way. It seems like everybody's personal short-term political calculus got us into this situation that is hardly being defended as a matter of actual policy.
It feels like this bill, insofar as Americans know a lot about it, and they don't. I mean, not even the people who voted for it know a lot about it because it was rushed through without hearings, without a CBO score, without most of the people who voted on it having read it or done anything more than skimmed it. Obamacare has become increasingly popular, not necessarily more economically stable as a venture, but it's more popular and people are worried about losing it. What's the political case? We'll get to the kind of policy case, but what's the political case that Republicans have that this was a smart vote to make? If they're going to replace something that's reasonably popular with something that is massively unpopular, it's going to cause disruption. Why do it?
Well, because they owe it to their supporters, and they've been promising their supporters this for years. And their supporters are the ones that are going to vote in the 2018 elections, and it's going to get better. I mean, this is the part of it that, so all of that seems plausible. And there's the budgetary effect of lowering the baseline so that it makes the tax debate during tax reform and tax cuts easier. In terms of the...
Can I just, just interrupt you for 1 second, because every time someone talks about this, how you have to do healthcare reform so you can make the tax reform better, I just would like to pause on the wicked silliness of this, which is you reduce government revenue so that it makes it easier to cut taxes to therefore reduce government revenue even more.
Right.
It's so bizarre there's got to be some term for how perverse that is. Anyway,
well, it's a necessity of congressional accounting. It's not a policy move. It's not made on policy grounds. It's made on kind of make the accounting easier for the tax cut piece grounds. So it's, yeah, it's not being argued on for policy reasons. And none of this is being argued on policy reasons because of the sort of multiple pronged way they have to do this because of the Senate reconciliation rules. Any of the stuff that the conservatives want in healthcare reform, and this is what's going to make this difficult, a lot of the stuff that they want in healthcare reform has to be passed on its own standalone piece of legislation, which would require 60 votes in the Senate. And they're not going to get 60 votes in the Senate because 8 Democrats are unlikely to sign on to it because of the unpopularity that you talked about. This isn't going to get more popular. A bill that was rushed through with no CBO score, where people now have admitted they didn't read it, and where people are sort of discovering what's in the bill, that's not going to make it more popular. And it has the potential to put the stink on this bill so that if you're a Republican having to defend it, and there may be a long period between when Republicans have to defend the House bill and when they can jump onto a Republican alternative in the Senate that might be more palatable, because only if a more palatable option is put together in the Senate will you be able to get the votes of Susan Collins and Dean Heller and others who are more moderate on this issue. So there's going to be a long period of time where it just kind of sits there, and health care is going to be defined by the bill that just passed the House. And that's going to be tricky if you already have two facts out there, which is that it went through without a score and that people voted for it who don't really know what's in it.
And then there's the actual content of the bill, which is causing enormous consternation among people with pre-existing conditions, among people who fear losing their Medicaid. I mean, I think the degree of just fear and uncertainty this is creating among a lot of Americans is like very palpable. And you know, it's interesting because given that a lot of the uncertainty in the bill comes from this question of how many states will actually take advantage of these waivers, which drive a truck hole through any kind of guarantee of health care, we don't even really know how many people will be affected or where. But I feel like there's this pervasive sense that someone's going to come and take my healthcare, your healthcare away. And the end of the employer mandate actually extends that beyond the health insurance exchanges and beyond Medicaid into...
Wait, that is something I missed. Wait, what about the end of the employer mandate? What do you mean?
Yeah, they took out the idea that
that larger employers have to provide
essential health benefits. Right. And so employers, I mean, in the past, when employers didn't have this mandate, most of them did provide the kind of essential health benefits that we've gotten used to. But the mandate that they have to would be gone if this bill became law. And so that starts to hit the, I think, 94 million or somewhere around there number of people who have healthcare through their employers.
This episode is brought to you by FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil, now streaming only on Hulu.
John, you were talking a minute ago about the Senate. So let's go into a little bit more detail about what is going to happen here.
I'm just a bill. Yes, I'm only a bill. And I got as far as Capitol Hill.
So from my deep constitutional study of Schoolhouse Rock, the Senate will now consider the House's bill.
Most bills never even get this far. I hope they decide to report on me favorably, otherwise I may die.
Die?
Yeah, die in committee. Oh, but it looks like I'm going to live. Now I go to the House of Representatives and they vote on me.
If they vote yes, what happens?
Then I go to the Senate and the whole thing starts all over.
But it doesn't sound like the Senate has any intention of actually considering the bill that the House passed.
Yeah, I think they've said that they won't consider the House bill, which is a change. Originally, 6 weeks ago or so, the Senate had said they were going to consider the House bill. So I think now they're going to consider their own. The John Cornyn, the number two on the Republican side, said they're going to take their time. There's been lots of skepticism or open opposition to the House bill. So the three or four main problems are, A, the question of pre-existing conditions, which seems to center around basically the notion that states can charge increased premiums if you have a gap of 63 days in coverage. I may have missed in the various different versions of the bill and what's finally in this bill. But anyway, the basic notion that people with pre-existing conditions won't see their prices go up so astronomically that basically having access doesn't really mean anything because you have access to something you can't afford. Secondarily, then you have this question of the essential health benefits, what will be guaranteed. Then you have the question of Medicaid and the reforms of Medicaid, knocking people off of Medicaid or making it so that people didn't have access to Medicaid. And then finally, related to that is the big number of people who would be who would lose their health insurance by the definition of the Congressional Budget Office, which is that big, ugly number And that was 24 million would lose it, as, according to the original CBO score. We don't know what the new number is going to be now, but it's going to be close to as bad. Those are all things that have to get fixed in the Senate bill. And then, you know, and then what happens? I think Emily's right. Then it's up to the Freedom Caucus again to decide whether they can stomach this bill.
Do you think, Emily, that the Senate will even bother to do it? Because one option the Senate has is simply just to not really take it seriously. And just they don't. I think if you got Mitch McConnell and John Cornyn in a room and secretly asked them, do you want to pass a big health care reform bill on Republican principles? They'd be like, no, they would actually not want to do it.
Even in their hearts, they feel that way, though. What choice do they have now? I mean, the ball is in their court. This is the promise that a lot of there are Republican senators who don't want to sign on to this version of repealing Obamacare, but haven't almost all the Republican senators said 8 million times that they want to repeal Obamacare?
But they don't really want to do it.
It's like sitting there in front of them, what would their excuse be for, like, we're just too busy? I mean, all the idea that they have to do this first, what we were talking about before, so then they can make tax reform easier. And, oh, by the way, give even more trillions of dollars back to the wealthiest part of the country. Like, all of that rhetoric has been out there. How do they, what argument would they make to get out of this now?
Do you think, I guess you're right. I guess they can't. So if we assume that the Senate will craft a bill which is more moderate, which they can get Susan Collins and what's his name from Ohio to sign on to?
Rob Portman.
That if they craft a bill that Rob Portman, Susan Collins can sign on to, do you think that the Freedom Caucus is going to be so principled that they are... that they won't settle for a bill like that? Or do you think at this point the House Republicans are really eager to get the win and will surrender that principle?
Well, the Freedom Caucus has been they killed it the first time in concert with and joining hands with the moderates in the Tuesday group. So I think so. Yeah, I think that's possible. I think one of the reasons the moderates gave in, even though the bill became more conservative, is in part because moderates are moderates for a reason. They can be convinced that let this pass, it'll go to the Senate, get changed, and it's okay. And conservatives in the Freedom Caucus would say, no, I'm not going to go along with your game. It's either going to be fixed the way I want it or not. So, you know, that's the big next test, is whether they would go along for the party. And when the president talked about how, you know, Republicans are learning to govern, what he's basically saying is, Freedom Caucus members need to learn the responsibilities of giving in order to get something passed. Have they learned that lesson? Is that what that's a question to ask. Does the White House think they've learned that lesson from this passage? Because they're going to see it again. And so if they've learned it, then when they see it again, they'll bend a little bit to get the bigger result.
How the hell would they have learned that lesson?
They learned the opposite lesson. Stand your ground and you get what you want.
Precisely.
And we'll move the bill to the right.
Precisely.
Straw-manning me. I didn't even realize he was straw-manning me.
Can I add one more thing, which is a looming fight over defunding Planned Parenthood? It will be very hard, I would think, for the House Freedom Caucus to vote for this bill without that provision. There are senators like Lisa Murkowski and Susan Collins for whom it will be very hard to defund Planned Parenthood. Now, the Senate could lose Murkowski and Collins and still pass this bill.
That's all they can lose, though.
That's it. That would be it. I sort of think that's what's going to happen. I think Collins and Murkowski, especially Collins, is going to get cut loose in this. She's not on the list of the 12 senators, all men, by the way, who are supposedly involved in this drafting. Neither is Murkowski. Neither is Cassidy, who the senator from Louisiana who had drafted this alternative Cassidy Collins healthcare plan, which is like a somewhat interesting option of the bad ideas on the table. At least it allows blue states that like Obamacare to keep it. So anyway, it just seems to me like the Senate is going to temper this bill somewhat, but that if there's any prayer for the House Freedom Caucus to vote for it, and they do really seem to be in the driver's seat to a great degree, then Collins and Murkowski seem more expendable to me in terms of the vote count than the Freedom Caucus.
So what's going to happen? The main reason that the House jammed this through as quickly as it did, is that it didn't want to get a CBO score and it didn't want to go into recess without to face constituents who were furious at them again. both furious because they hadn't done anything and furious because they were considering getting rid of Obamacare. They're going to go home to constituencies that are going to be as energized, if not more, than they were in March on the left, and not all only on the left, people who feel their health care is in danger. I mean, this whole pre-existing condition notion is that, oh, pre-existing condition, that's from other people. We are all living with a pre-existing, every single person in the country either has a pre-existing condition or is deeply connected to someone with a pre-existing condition. So it's no minority. It's all of us. So they're going to face town halls. They're going to face this massive opposition, and senators are going to face it as well. How do you think, John, they're going to answer to that, and also answer to the process question that they jammed it through? Or are they just going to be like, suck it, we passed it?
Well, members of the House have a tougher job here than the Senate, because what the senators will say is, yes, there are things that need to be fixed, and we'll fix it in the Senate. So they can get through. Now, the question then is how and what are you going to do and all the rest. But still, they have a little escape valve on that. For the members of Congress who voted for this without getting a CBO score, they'll have to say, well, we don't agree with the way the CBO counts things. Of course, they're going to count people as having insurance who they forced to buy insurance. But we're trying to remove that because we don't want government to be coercive in your life. And we think that once you remove the coercion and let the free market go, that there will be all of this savings. And then it seems to me a big problem, if for no other reason than that not getting a score is just not doing it the regular way. And that anytime you've got to break the rules to do something, it does undermine the central thing. And so you can have an answer, but it's just never, it seems to me, going to sound that satisfying. Except to people who are just happy you voted for it and don't really care. You know, and there will be a lot of those who will see this as a promise kept and anything to kill Obamacare.
Well, that's what depresses me, is that the kind of hypocrisy, the destruction of the process, we've become such a partisan, we're in such a partisan and dire place that none of that stuff matters anymore. People just want the win. They're like so happy with the win that they don't care that everyone's a total hypocrite and is not living at all by what they said 6 years ago, 8 years ago. It's depressing.
Right. I mean, the other thing is, like, there's no reason for this to be happening. Like, the country is absolutely prosperous enough to continue to make it easier for low-income people and people who don't get health insurance through their employers to have health insurance. Like, this is a basic, basic thing. And the notion that there is some great principle of freedom at stake that is worth taking the money we're spending on basic healthcare for those people and giving it back to super wealthy people.
I'm so with you, Emily. It depresses me and embarrasses me when I think about that a country as rich as we are has this totally misguided, stupid system of health care. It is so wrong. It's maddening. Every other country as wealthy as ours has some kind of system of universal health care, often a single-payer system of universal health care, not employer-based, and that doesn't, you know, have this idea of pre-existing conditions. I bet when foreigners come to the United States and they hear pre-existing conditions, they don't even know what we're talking about. It must be one of these phrases that just has no meaning in other parts of the world. And right. It's gobsmacking to me that after all this time, for a set of principles around freedom and choice that are just bullshit principles that people don't actually want, people don't actually really care, and they are not equipped to make real decisions the way in a marketplace you can to make a decision about what kind of car you buy or what kind of house you buy, where there is an actual autonomy and information and you're not under duress when you make those decisions. To think that healthcare is a market like that is so wrong and misguided, and it depresses me.
Right.
On Death, Sex, and Money, we feature interviews with you, our community of listeners, getting honest about uncomfortable things.
I developed an illness where it isn't safe for me to drive. A friend once said to me, sex is like air. You don't think about it until you're not getting enough. This is a similar sort of thing if you just replace sex with driving.
Listen to Death, Sex, and Money wherever you get podcasts.
I mean, David, I suppose the response to what you're saying about losing this, I don't even want to call it a benefit, losing this basic necessity, is that if people don't like it, they can vote other politicians into office who will provide health insurance. You know, of course, that takes us back to the reality that a lot of the people who are going to be directly affected if a bill like this becomes law are Trump supporters in red states.
I hope that people do that. I think the victory that Democrats will may harvest off of this in 2018 and perhaps in 2020 will come not because they have gotten a lot of Trump voters. However, I think it's that they're hopefully going to galvanize an electorate that is apathetic and get people to come out and vote and feel like I am actually under threat and I need to turn out and make a difference.
Right. There is this underlying question, though, about inequality, like what level and degree of inequality is this country really willing to tolerate in exchange for the kind of profound cultural differences that shape how people vote? I mean, those two really important pillars of how people think and vote and what their values are coming into real conflict here. Although it's also on the Democrats to provide a real alternative, I should say.
John, let's finish this. Can you bring us back to President Trump, who we haven't talked about that much? But
yeah.
What's his role going to be?
Yeah, his role here, you know, he negotiated. But for a person who came into office claiming, you know, supernatural powers of negotiation, there was nothing about this negotiation that was particularly revolutionary or surprising or as innovative and creative and challenging and norm-breaking as all the stuff he did during the campaign. Just in the larger sense of having to either sell this to the country, just calling it beautiful and wonderful and great is not really that impressive of a negotiating technique in terms of selling it to the country. So I wonder if he will be able to improve his ability to sell something to the country, because so far it's actually not been that innovative or impressive. And there is some point at which Republican senators are going to have to be sold on this, and they are less receptive to the president's techniques as they've been demonstrated in this first stage. Secondarily, there is another phase of this that the president keeps talking about, but he talked about in our interview the notion of being able to sell plans across state lines and those kinds of things, which are things that Republicans want and which would take care of some of the downsides of this first part of the three-part program. But that requires 60 votes in the Senate, which means convincing 8 Democrats. And so is the president going to do that? Right now, he's essentially done very, very little to even mouth the words of unity in the country. So where are those 8 Democrats going to come from? He's got a role to play, and so far it doesn't look like he's got anything particularly special to offer in that role, even though this was basically one of the signature promises of his presidency.
And what happens, John, to all the broken promises? I mean, Trump is on the record as saying, I'm not going to take away Medicaid. I'm going to give you health insurance with lower deductibles, lower copays. It's going to be better. And that is the opposite of what this bill is producing.
Well, I think that's why the bill, in part, maybe why it's unpopular. His voters, who are quite strong in their affections for him, I think you're going to, for that to break off, I think it has to, people have to start feeling it. I mean, I think premiums have to go up, care has to be diminished, people have to be denied. I mean, there have to be real consequences that people feel if they are going to leave Donald Trump because of health care.
But basically, people have to suffer to give the lie to this. That's what just keeps getting at me.
Well, that's,
I think you're right, but I just like it's kind of it's shocking. It should be shocking to us.
Well, it depends. But we'll see what finally passes. I mean, it's the anticipation of suffering that had the vote so close and that is keeping Republicans from supporting this in the Senate. So it hasn't happened yet.
All right, let's leave it there. As this discussion was going on, guys, just for those of you considering coming to our live show in Denver, Governor Hickenlooper of Colorado is going to be our special guest, I learned.
Oh, that's so great.
Yeah. So that's going to be on June the 7th in Denver, Colorado. So look at slate.com/live to get tickets for that.
Or come to our show in D.C.
Or come to our show in D.C. on May 10th. Yeah. Which is next week. Also slate.com/live. Thanks for listening. Our intern is Kevin Townsend. Our producer is Jocelyn Frank. Steve Lichtai is the executive producer of Slate Podcast. June Thomas is the managing editor of Slate Podcast. Andy Bowers is like in charge of all the other stuff. You can tweet at us at Slate Gabfest. Gabfest at Slate.com is our email address. And, well, all that stuff. For Emily Bazelon and John Dickerson, I'm David Plotz. Thanks for listening to this Gabfest Extra. We'll talk to you next week.
Hi, this is Matt Rogers.
And this is Bowen Yang.
In a world that sometimes feels uncertain, where communities can be disconnected, there are beacons of hope in your neighborhood.
Introducing Neighbor to Neighbor, a California volunteers network.
They believe that the people living all around you are your best bet at creating meaningful social bonds and preparing you for the next big weather event.
Whether it's lending a helping hand to a neighbor in need or standing together in times of natural disaster, Neighbor to Neighbor empowers you to grow your community.
Visit caneighbors.com to learn how you can help build a more connected community.
Hi, this is Dahlia Lithwick, host of Slate's legal podcast, Amicus. If you're listening to this show, you might be interested in Amicus's live show that we're hosting in Washington, D.C. on Tuesday, May the 14th. My colleague, Mark Joseph Stern, and I will be talking to some amazing guests, including Sherrilyn Ifill and a sitting state Supreme Court justice, all about how originalism, a relatively recently invented way of interpreting the Constitution, has taken over the Supreme Court and radically reshaped the law. It's been doctrinal rocket fuel for the conservative legal movement and facilitated the rolling back of abortion rights, the expansion of gun rights, and the obliteration of the separation of church and state. And as another wildly consequential Supreme Court term careers to its end, the court's originalists are on a tear. But there's something you can do about it, and we hope you'll join us in D.C. on May 14th to explore the possible pathways out of the current situation. Go to slate.com/amicuslive for tickets.